Hi, welcome to this collection of spiritual experiences, numbers 1 through 6, found separately on my website. I've joined them together here into one audio file, in case you'd like to hear them all in a row. These experiences are quite different from one another, and they highlight major milestones in my early spiritual progress. Thank you for joining me for Spiritual Experiences, Case 1. My earliest recollection of a spiritual experience, where I was significantly involved in the praying, is from when I was around 8 years old. Family members have told me of earlier experiences, but this was the first one where my own praying and the resulting spiritual realization is what I remember most clearly. My parents came into Christian Science when I was about 6 months old, so I attended the Christian Science Sunday School from an early age. We learned about the Ten Commandments and the Beatitudes and Bible stories, as well as the Lord's Prayer, along with Mary Baker Eddy's spiritual interpretation of it. In Sunday school, I learned that God is love, and that God's protecting love is always available to us, wherever we are. My Sunday school teacher used to say that anything bad or hurtful is error, and error is no more real than the hole in a donut. One morning when I was walking to school with friends, we stopped to lean over a low fence and check out the brook that ran under the street. Occasionally we'd throw rocks in the brook, and once I'd seen a muskrat, which was pretty exciting. As we're leaning over this fence, looking into the brook, my friend shouts, "Hey, watch out, there's poison ivy all over." I look down to see a patch of ripe, shiny poison ivy leaves wrapped all over the fence. But I wasn't afraid, and said, "Poison ivy can't hurt me." My friends said I was crazy, so just to show them I didn't even believe in poison ivy, I grabbed 2 fistfuls of the dark, shiny leaves and rubbed them vigorously all over my face, as if scrubbing my face with a washcloth. I guess my friends were really impressed. Anyway, it was getting late, so we ran along to school, and I didn't give it another thought. At noon, I went home for lunch, and when I walked into the kitchen, my mom took one look at me and said, "Jimmy, what did you do to your face? It's all red." I told her the story, and she was not happy. She spoke to me about the Bible story where Jesus is tempted by the devil, and the devil dares him to cast himself down from the temple. The devil says, "Go ahead, God'll take care of you." And Jesus replies, "Thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God." My mom explained that when we look for error to show God's power over it, it's as if we have made it real. I guess for me, the point of the story was that we can turn to God for help and healing, but that prayer isn't for doing tricks or trying to impress our friends. Well, my mom was really mad, and she said, "Go to your room and know the truth." Know the truth is a phrase Christian Science uses to describe one way to pray. From the Bible verse, "Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." Upstairs in my room, I sat down on my bed and took out my Bible and Christian Science textbook, Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures, by Mary Baker Eddy, and went right to the Lord's Prayer, where she provides a spiritual interpretation, which we had been studying in Sunday school. About halfway through, where she gives an interpretation for the "Forgive us our debts" part, she uses the words, "And love is reflected in love." That caught my attention because in Sunday school, we had learned that we are the spiritual reflections of God. I focused on this passage that love is reflected in love. I reasoned that God is love with the big L, and I am his reflection, love, with a little L. As God's reflection, I was not material, not a goofy kid trying to show off, but the spiritual reflection of love, of the divine love that is God. There was only divine love, and me as its reflection, its image and likeness. There wasn't some dumb kid, just divine love. It was pure and simple, and it just sunk in. Then I felt the presence of that divine love all around me, a gentle sense of love's warmth, and as if a soft light filling my room. I forgot about the poison ivy or being in trouble with my mom. I was just sitting on my bed basking in the palpable awareness of being surrounded in God's love. My mom called to say lunch was ready, and when I got down to the kitchen, she looked at me and said, "Jimmy, what did you do?" My face was completely clear. There was no trace of the poison ivy. It was gone, and it stayed gone. As you might imagine, I've thought about this a lot over the years, and I have a few observations. The experience was so dramatic that it was more than a few decades before I started to reflect seriously on the lessons learned. My first takeaway was that our spiritual reflection of divine love is really showing forth our true spiritual selfhood. One thing that occurred to me fairly recently is that I never actually saw it. I never looked at my face. So I wasn't trying to be healed of physical symptoms. Rather, I was praying for forgiveness, or perhaps you could say for atonement. I imagine the outcome might have been quite different had I looked in the mirror and then tried to pray to make a rash go away. I don't even like to think about that. It's a basic idea in Christian Science that looking at a problem usually makes it harder to solve. It's usually much more helpful to be looking toward the spiritual solution. I'm still thinking about how this idea may relate to that principle in quantum mechanics that the state of a system is indeterminate until it is observed. I have a feeling there may be some connection. It's interesting that Mary Baker Eddy's sentence that led to my healing was about forgiveness. For the longest time, the phrase, "and love is reflected in love," has meant to me exactly what I thought it meant when I was 8 years old. It was decades before I really thought about how else it might relate to forgiveness. Perhaps it just lifts us up, and there's nothing left to forgive, just divine love and its reflection, embracing all parties involved. As with most healings I've had, my prayer and the ultimate solution, realization and healing, had nothing to do with what one might have initially diagnosed as the physical problem. In this case, the solution had nothing to do with poison ivy, or inflammation, or skin rashes, or anything else associated with a material assessment of the problem. As for the question of how erasing the problem from the tablet of my mentality also erased it from the skin of my face, well, that's a question for another day. Thank you for listening. Hi, and thanks for joining me for Spiritual Experiences Case 2. This is about a classroom experience rather than one with external observable effects like cases 1 and 3, but it's foundational, as it came about 10 years after case 1 and 3 years before case 3. I would be remiss if I didn't include it, although I'm aware that it is pretty abstract and radical. So here's the story. In the spring of 1966, my senior year in high school, I showed up for my usual class in the Christian Science Sunday School in Wellesley, Mass. Our teacher was Joseph G. Hurd, and our class usually had 3 to 5 or more students. I mention his full name because you can find 2 of his Christian Science lectures from the 70s on the web. On this particular Sunday, I was the only one who showed up, so it was just me and Joe. He had been a naval officer in the Pacific during World War II and a Navy chaplain in the Korean War. He had a law degree and was a member of the Florida Bar. And now he was a Christian Science practitioner and worked in the Christian Science headquarters in Boston. I'd known him for some years and we had a friendly and comfortable rapport. As we got into our class discussion, I asked him something I'd been wondering about. How puzzling it is to imagine the extent of the universe, since it's hard to imagine that it is infinite, and hard to imagine that it isn't. Joe pointed out that the real universe isn't out there, but is within the divine consciousness. It is in the mind of God, the divine mind, in whom we live and move and have our being. If we think of the universe as being spiritual, dwelling in divine consciousness, it's easy to think of it as being infinite. It can go on forever, like the range of our thinking. That made sense. I don't remember how we got to the next point, but we considered the nature of what might be substance in that spiritual universe. Joe talked about how the substance of reality isn't material stuff, but spiritual, and that spiritual stuff, at its essence, comes from the divine energy of God's love. We talked about that for a while, and I still remember the words of my realization. The energy of spiritual love is the essential substance of all existence. For some reason, I perceived and sensed the actuality of those words. It was like seeing a little cloud in my mind's eye that represented the energy of spiritual love, and perceiving it to be the actual and true substance of reality. Then we talked about how, since the true substance of the universe is spiritual, it is then certainly not material. Joe mentioned that a prominent physicist had described the building blocks of subatomic matter as nothing moving swiftly, which appealed to me since I'd been studying physics in high school. That led us to a familiar conclusion in Christian Science, that if spirit is real, then matter is unreal. I asked the obvious next question. If matter is unreal, and looking around us at the class table, where did this unreality come from? The answer he offered was simple. As I remember it, the way it hit me was that if matter is not substance, if it is unreal, and there is no matter, then it makes no sense to ask where it comes from. It doesn't come from anywhere. There isn't any. It seemed like his answer pulled the rug right out from under the question, where does this unreal picture come from? It may have lifted our discussion to a transcendent vision, an entirely spiritual level. To the logic of human sense, it seemed kind of ridiculous. On the other hand, it followed as a logical consequence of the earlier insights. This conclusion was at once completely spiritually logical, and yet, to so-called material sense, it was more than a little absurd. Yet it fit perfectly with a sense of holy spiritual logic. I loved it. Looking back, I have often attributed my comprehension of that concept not only to grasping the substantiality of the divine energy of spiritual love, but also to having an appreciation, perhaps even a bit of delight, for an idea that in a funny way made no sense at all. I liked the nonsense aspect of it, as well as the logical part. It was probably because I had so clearly seen the energy of spiritual love as the essential substance of existence, of all reality, that I had the standpoint from which to comfortably accept the idea that it is absolutely true, from an entirely spiritual standpoint, to say there is no matter, even though it might not look that way when viewing our world superficially. I should probably add that this doesn't deny the good we see around us. It just recognizes it as having its substance in spiritual ideas rather than in mindless stuff separate from thought. And to paraphrase a Bible verse, the things of the Spirit are foolishness to the natural man. This would certainly be a good example of that. The comprehension and acceptance of those few conclusions became a foundation for my spiritual thinking and spiritual progress. After a few decades, I came to realize that the ideas Joe explained that day, a spiritual reality dwelling entirely in divine consciousness, accessible to us through reflection, the energy of spiritual love as the essential substance of existence, and the utter invalidity of matter as a factor in truth. Those basic ideas represented essential building blocks of spiritual thinking in Christian Science. After more than a half century, I can still picture myself walking home from that Sunday school class, very aware that no matter what things ever looked like from then on, the spiritual world was, in a deep and profound sense, the only one that really mattered. If you haven't heard Spiritual Experiences Case 3 yet, you may want to check it out. It's an example of how these basic principles can be demonstrated in practice. Thanks for listening. Until next time. Spiritual Experiences, Case 3. Here is an illustrative story that also involved a physical healing. It's probably one of the top two experiences I've had to date in terms of being spiritually educational. It was the summer of 1969, after my junior year in college, and I was doing 6 weeks of Navy ROTC midshipman training aboard an old destroyer, the USS Charles S. Sperry, DD-697, out of Newport, Rhode Island. After standing many long quarterdeck watches in port, in ill-fitting white dress shoes, one of my feet became infected and swollen. I was fortunate to be able to take weekend liberty and travel to my parents' summer house in Rockport, Mass., some hours away by bus. I remember sitting at the desk in their living room on a Saturday morning, preparing to pray for my foot, which was by then looking like it had swallowed a bloated pink softball. What little I knew about Christian Science treatment was that the first rule is to allay the fear. So I searched my mind and wrote down on a notepad all the things I would be afraid of, and then started to systematically pray about each item. I wouldn't be able to fulfill my shipboard duties. I didn't know how to give a Christian Science treatment. I wasn't capable of it. It wouldn't work. I would get blood poisoning and lose my foot, or worse, etc. Then I reached out to what I knew of God for the spiritual truth about each of these fears, and used prayers of spiritual reasoning to see my way clear of each of them, specifically affirming the truth and denying the error in each case. At some point, after an hour or two, I felt comforted and confident that my prayers were complete and effective, that I had handled all the fears. At that point, expecting healing, I looked to see if my foot was better, and was disappointed and a little perplexed to see no change at all. As that day continued and into the next, I periodically revisited my prayers and wondered how what was then to me an obvious truth, my spiritual perfection as an image of God, was to be manifested in the physical healing of my foot. On Sunday, I hobbled with my parents to the local Christian Science church service and then hobbled back home again. While waiting for my mom to prepare lunch, I went out on the patio under a sunny blue sky and read a Christian Science Sentinel, the weekly periodical that includes testimonies of healing. This one included a testimony from a woman who had had a disfiguring growth on her face. The woman had been praying with a Christian Science practitioner, and during one call, the practitioner asked her if she was healed. The patient said no. The practitioner asked, "How do you know?" The patient said, "I looked in the mirror." The practitioner said, "That's not how you tell if you're healed. You look to spiritual sense to see the real spiritual man that you are." That really hit me. I realized I shouldn't be looking at my foot for the proof of healing, but to spiritual sense. So I put my socks on, so I could no longer check the condition of my foot. I had been working with the idea that man is really spiritual, not material. So I looked up to God and reached out in thought, as if looking up beyond the sunny blue sky, even outside the material or human realm, to see my spiritual selfhood, to see God's spiritual man. And pretty much immediately, I saw it. Well, actually, I saw an abstract image that was somewhat geometrical and seemed to have a reflective quality to it. It was like a triangular pattern of clear ice held vertically, like a mirror with an extraordinary twinkling brightness shining through. But the visual representation was not the important part. When I looked at it, it was like I automatically knew things. It was as if seeing this mirror-like abstract representation was conveying to me pure spiritual information. The first thing I knew about it, and I've struggled to put this into words, was that it had an unbelievable and almost overwhelming quality of wholeness, a fathomless, ineffable wholeness with many exclamation points. Right in the heels of that recognition was the awareness that due to this extraordinary and perfect wholeness, it couldn't possibly have a problem. The next thing I saw was like I was in a mirror looking out on the original, and I was aware that I was related to, in fact defined by, this wholeness as its reflection. I had a relationship to the thing I was seeing, as if I was its reflection in a mirror. That defined me. It was my source, and I was aware of the precision and exactness of that relationship. I immediately knew that what it was reflected exactly in what I was. I was aware that my own identity and selfhood, my being, came directly from that original. I was like it. With all this, my human beliefs were completely dominated and transformed, and I absolutely knew I was healed. As I was sitting there basking in the glow and wonder of this experience, I had no thought of my human situation, no concern, no interest. The spiritual knowing I had experienced completely superseded all of that. All of this had taken place entirely above my sense of my physical self and body sitting on the lounge chair. When all this was finished, and the whole process may have taken less than 10 seconds, I came back down to earth, so to speak, where I was sitting in a lounge chair on the patio in the summer sun. Immediately I felt a tingling in my foot, like pins and needles, that lasted a few seconds, and I thought to myself, ah, that must be the physical healing taking place, although it had already taken place completely in my consciousness before I even landed back on the ground, so to speak. It seemed like my physical sense of myself was simply conforming to the spiritual, where the healing had already taken place. I put on my shoes and laced them up, had lunch with my parents, then took the train into Boston,
walked a mile with luggage to visit my sister, and then took the bus back to the ship that night. And I never looked at my foot or ever had a problem with it again. In retrospect, it was apparent that what I saw at first wasn't actually me. It wasn't just my spiritual selfhood. It was way bigger. It was a universal, as if one infinite spiritual manifestation of God's perfect spiritual man. My experience was, and is, just one individual instance of that reflected, astounding spiritual wholeness, as you are.
Hi, thanks for joining me for Spiritual Experiences Case 4. This story begins after teaching Sunday school on a glorious sunny day in late May. I was driving home with the top down on my VW Bug and crossing a bridge over the railroad tracks, passed by a very pretty teenage girl walking along the sidewalk, dressed in her Sunday best. She looked so fresh and pure and lovely in the sunshine. Her goodness just sparkled. Her loveliness captured my imagination, and when I got home, her impression was still powerfully persistent in my mind. I realized that if I kept thinking about her in a personal or physical way, it would lead me in a wrong direction. After all, I was an aspiring Christian Science practitioner and a Sunday school teacher. I should probably mention that I was 27 years old. I found, however, as much as I tried, I couldn't put her out of my mind. It wasn't enough to merely discipline my thought or replace the thoughts that were tempting me with striving for purity, statements of spiritual truth, or denials of the errors that were so obvious. I could tell that I had spiritual work to do, and I needed to know I wasn't separated from whatever goodness was beckoning me. After grabbing some lunch, I sat down at my desk to commit my afternoon to study and prayer, and to translate the thoughts and feelings that were so attracting me into words and thence to spiritual ideas I knew I could keep for real. I wanted to know the spiritual truths that were knocking on my mental door. I wanted the spiritual substance, and I wanted to know the words. As I followed my thoughts and feelings and looked up various words in the Bible and the writings of Mary Baker Eddy, along with using the dictionary and concordances, my thinking was drawn to the realization that spiritual ideas alone held the answers to my yearnings. I still have my handwritten study notes from that day. I've interspersed most of them here in the narrative. He who perceives the true idea of life loses corporeal desires and torments. To be spiritually minded is life. The satisfaction of life is in being spiritually minded. I knew that in theory, the satisfaction of life had to be spiritual in being spiritually minded, but in practical terms, that seemed like a great leap into what seemed like a world of abstractions, so far from the loveliness that had captured my mind. The notes continue. If to be spiritually minded is life, then I do want to be spiritually minded, and nothing can talk me out of it. There's no suggestion that to be spiritually minded is vacuity or emptiness. I will be spiritually minded. The good life is kept from me only as I can be kept from being spiritually minded. As I worked with these ideas, following the words and passages where they led, I realized the only viable path forward was for me to be spiritually minded about all the joys of life. More notes. I always have and will experience life completely. Life is not confined in the forms which reflect it. The beauty, joy, and freshness of life are immortal and can never fade away from me, because life is my soul, mind, spirit. The joy and satisfaction and beauty of life is in being spiritually minded. After wrestling with this for some time, I could tell there was a decision to be made. It came down to making a commitment to being spiritually minded against all else. A decision to be satisfied with having all my treasures of joy and loveliness be entirely spiritually mental in God. As this came to a head in my mind, I felt I had to choose. I had to offer up for sacrifice all my human hopes, even all my religious aspirations, all my desires and ambitions, as if on the altar of being spiritually minded. More notes. I don't want a home, family, wife, car, house, job, or supply. All I want is to be spiritually minded, and nothing can stop me from being spiritually minded. It became clear that I could take none of that baggage with me into the kingdom of heaven. Rising to the challenge was a poignant, deeply felt moment, a moment of sacrifice and a commitment to an ascended spiritual idealism, which at that moment seemed a stark and barren abstraction. It was like I was trading everything that was humanly good and tangible for something that was intangible, existing only as an exalted spiritual ideal, only in the heights of my mind. But I somehow knew it was the path I had to take. After I had made what felt like that giant step, reaching for that invisible, spiritually mental substance, and most clearly leaving all else behind, I felt a sense of peace. The notes continue. Spirit is the source of all my thoughts. Because I am spiritually minded, I am satisfied. Spirit saith, I am life. Come unto me. I continued in a more relaxed way with my study, and a few moments later, suddenly, in a flood of spiritual realization, these words from him virtually exploded inside me. O life that maketh all things new, the blooming earth, the thoughts of men. The words came alive, flowering and blooming, in newness, freshness, and loveliness. All the sparkle, goodness, innocence, and purity that I loved were shown forth from the spiritual life that is God, infinite spirit. I experienced all those lovely things inside me, not just in my mind, but deep down inside. I knew and experienced that I could never be separated from spiritual loveliness, that the purity and goodness and the romantic hope of love forever are not out there in material things and persons, but are spiritual. And in all their brilliant reality, they come to us direct from God. In considering this, I understood that the loveliness I had been drawn to, the spiritual idea that beckoned me from that human experience, was the spiritual idea of life itself, life as spirit, and life in spirit. I was completely healed of any sense of separation from all that good in one stunning moment. I found the newness and freshness and sparkle of life springing up inside me. I found the spiritual life that maketh all things new within. Without really knowing it, that is what I had longed for, and that is what I found. My last notes from that day. To do thy will is more than praise, as words are less than deeds. That afternoon is more than a major milestone in my spiritual progress and the bestowal of a priceless spiritual treasure. It illustrates a principle and provides us with a promise. It was proof of the power of spirituality to redeem human life. and to show we can experience God's renewal and holiness here and now. It was a big step of practical fulfillment, in the loveliest way, of the mission of Christian Science, to take away the sins of the world. At that moment, all the sweet loveliness, the youthful innocence and romantic hopes, the freshness and beauty of my earlier encounter burst inside me in a cascade of flowering joy and exuberant spiritual feelings. And to this day, whenever I turn to those words, it rekindles many of those same feelings. Thank you for being a thoughtful listener. Until next time. Hi, thanks for joining me for Spiritual Experiences, Case 5. This one is a little different from the others because it involves solving a problem using a new approach to prayer that was basically developed on the fly. It involves a higher level of abstraction of spiritual thinking that I had not really encountered before. I believe it was my first introduction to what I have since called infinite spiritual thinking. I think a prerequisite to understanding the following experience might be to have had some success in demonstrating the power of spiritual prayer, and to have a good comfort level with thinking about infinity as a name for the infinite God principle that we commonly call God. This experience involved finding the solution to a problem at my job, where I had to recommend options for the deployment of some manufacturing machinery at several overseas factories after I'd come back from a week's data gathering trip to Europe. I need to find the best placement of equipment, accounting for the various different market forecasts, labor rates, capacities, and so forth. Getting to work, I sat down at my desk in my temporary windowless office on the 49th floor of the Prudential Tower in Boston, where I was on a special assignment. It didn't take long for me to discover that the required quantitative analysis was way over my head. It seemed very complicated, and I didn't even know where to start. So I started to pray about it to clear my head. As I prayed, the thing that came to me was to pray about confusion. At the time, I'd been devoting about an hour and a half a day to praying in the public practice of Christian Science, so I was not uncertain about the approach. I probably started my prayers about this work problem by establishing a sense of the power and presence of God, and then praying to know there is no confusion in God. The divine mind is not confused, but knows and understands all things clearly. And I possess that knowing and clarity by reflection. There's no evil or error or limitation to talk me out of my clear, calm, orderly, harmonious spiritual knowing, and so forth. In fact, I was pretty clear about the spiritual truth that there's no confusion in the divine mind, nor in mine. However, in going over that approach to handle confusion, that is, to make nothing of it, it didn't seem like I was getting any traction. A few years before, I had recorded on a cassette tape the 1941 Christian Science Journal article, "Being is Unfoldment," by Mary Sands Lee, and I'd been listening to it during my daily commutes. I just about memorized it. In this article, she writes that unfolding infinity is the whole of being. The article is all about infinity, using it as a name for God, and it had really resonated with me. Now, in this case, my meditations on infinity inspired an intuitive reluctance to just use denials to handle this problem. In that moment, such denials seemed almost an affront to infinity, which is all-inclusive and has no opposites. As a result of my evolving comfort level with thinking about infinity as a name for God,
I was led to reach for a more inclusive frame of mind that would more aptly honor the spiritual idea of infinity. I looked up confusion in the dictionary. It's made up of con, which means with, and fusion, a coming together into one. So I wondered, is there any such thing as infinite confusion? I prayed, "Dear infinite love, be my only sense of confusion." That way of confusion was nothing to infinite love. It would be nothing to me. But if it had some meaning to infinite love, then I would find that out too. So I listened to this idea. I am the infinite confusion of infinite love. What does that mean? When I lifted my thought to God in those words, I got a glimmer, a wisp, of an infinite spiritual confusion. The infinite confusion of infinite love. I sensed that infinite confusion was everything coming together in oneness. It was a fusing into one, as if a coming together of angel ideas in the spectacular wholeness of being. This coming together resulted in a whole, clear, coherent one. I understood the sublimity of this divine confusion of angels. It was a new, dare I say, higher way of spiritual thinking, a higher level of spiritual abstraction that turned what had been a human negative into a divine positive. Confusion had ceased to be a negative. It was seen in a wisp of spiritual perception as an infinite idea of the convergence of angels in oneness. I was delighted with this discovery, and my mental problem went away. Pretty soon I was puttering at my desk as if a child playing with scissors and cardboard, with no conscious sense of focus or intention, not quite in a daydream. After a bit, I started to notice that my playing was producing something. I had cut up some pieces of cardstock and rotated one of them, and cut them like piano keys and stapled them together. I could see a solution taking shape. I put some finishing touches on it, added some labels, and found that I had assembled a device that modeled how to optimize the deployment of injection molding machinery in the company's factories in England, France, and Germany. I took the cardboard thing to my boss and explained the options. He followed the logic, then took my cardboard model and tossed it in his briefcase. I wish I still had it, where he was packing for a trip back to Europe, where he was to negotiate the solution with the various factory managers. That was it. Problem solved. In this case, not only was I healed of the confusion, but I was able to bring simple clarity to what had seemed confusing, and was able to share that simplicity with others. Afterward, I was quite aware that my prayerful consideration of the infinite idea of confusion was a different way of praying about negatives. A few years later, after continued successes in practice, I put this realization into the simple expression that the meaning of every infinite word is good. It might be fair to say that this experience, for me, ushered in a whole new way of looking at things. That's it. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Hi. Welcome to Spiritual Experiences, Case 6.
When I think about spiritual truth, or truth as a name for God, I often remember an experience I had in the late 1970s. I had been generally immersed in thinking about this topic for almost a decade, when one morning, as I was walking down the street to catch a bus to work, I was thinking and praying about spiritual truth, and I kept hovering at a point between feeling a great desire to declare and assert the presence, power, and activity of spiritual truth, something like a divine and absolute spiritual goodness, and having an equally strong awareness that because spiritual truth is true, I didn't need to be affirming it to make it true. You may remember from my YouTube video, Spiritual Experiences Case 1, that the Bible verse, "Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free," describes one way to pray as taught in Christian Science. At the end of that day, coming home from work, I was still flipping back and forth between declaring God's infinite spiritual truth and consciously not declaring it, based on the awareness that I didn't need to be declaring it, because it was already true. When I got home, I sat back in my recliner in this same frame of mind, as if hovering between knowing and not knowing, and I was soon, perhaps if from a daydream or reverie, taken by a spiritual vision. In its entirety, it was somewhat like a beam of light in front of me, starting on the lower left and proceeding to the upper right. It began unobtrusively, as if a soft, gentle light, a radiance. And then I could see it was a source, an active and originating source. The outcome of this source showed itself to be in the very process of being actively and continuously originated. Then, as if landing on a plateau, it showed itself to be good. Once recognized as good, it revealed itself to be not just regular good, but breathtaking good, hard to describe. Then it showed that its inherent quality of goodness of origin was so severe that it bristled with integrity. And this integrity evolved into a massively laser-like coherence that showed itself as if having a hard, impermeable shell, like it had battleship armor. This conspicuous inviolability showed that it would remain permanently, absolutely intact in its original perfection forever, no matter what. And that was it. I don't guess the whole thing took more than a minute. I've been thinking about this experience off and on over the last 40 years to learn more from it and to better put it into words. I'm struck by how many aspects of it are really hard to describe. I think the word for that is ineffable, that is, can't be expressed in words. Nevertheless, I try. I also wonder, in what paradigm and in what context is the information in this vision an answer to the timeless question, what is truth? It's a subtle point, but it occurred to me a few years later that what I saw was not truth itself, but in some sense a manifestation of truth, an image and likeness of truth. It was a visualization of the nature of its invisible source, seen through unfolding images of its outcome. I've got a number of other questions. What is the connection between truth and source or origin? How does extreme goodness translate into integrity? Where does the laser-like coherence come from? I had a spiritual vision about 15 years later that involved the coherence of infinite goodness. So coherence has my attention. And maybe the most important question of all is, what's with the protective shell? I sense that that is a big deal. It's also interesting to consider the frame of mind that seemed to have kicked off this whole process, hovering between knowing and not knowing. If you're curious about this, please watch my YouTube video, The Wholeness of the Infinite God Principle. Often in reviewing this experience, I picked up new ideas about it, so please forgive me for what might seem like repetition. Meditating on these topics is time well spent, so I'm going to reiterate here.
To help me organize my thoughts, I've parsed this vision into 8 different ideas. The basic rhythm of it was like a 4-stage rocket, but each stage seemed to have 2 parts. 1. It began as if a soft, holy light, quite evidently acting as a source. 2. Its outcome visually showed itself in a state of being actively originated, almost like watching a baby being born, but more dynamic, like watching an ongoing transformation. 3. The thing that was originated was seen to be good. Not an adjective, but the noun, good. 4. It wasn't just regular good, but it was breathtaking good. You may remember the end of the first chapter of Genesis, where God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. Well, this wasn't just very good. It was very, very, very good. Deep, boundless, overflowing good. 5. I could see and feel the quality of this goodness reached back as if connected to its origin. And the severity of this goodness showed it bristling with integrity. 6. That integrity evolved into an extraordinary, powerful, laser-like coherence. 7. This laser-like coherence showed itself to be inviolable and unassailable. Did you know that the armor on the side of a battleship with 16-inch guns is typically 16 inches thick? That was the sense I got from this. Battleship armor. 8. And I could see this coherence and inviolability would protect and maintain its original startling goodness forever. Each of these stages was, in some sense, over the top, impossible to really describe in a way that completely does it justice. Each stage was filled with wonder. So now when I think about truth as a name for God, I think about a radiant source and roiling spiritual origination. It's overwhelming, very, very, very goodness. The severity of its quality of goodness of origin, how it bristled with integrity, showing forth a laser-like coherence that evidenced its inviolability, maintaining its integrity and goodness forever. Pretty interesting stuff. Thanks for listening. This is an epilogue to Spiritual Experiences Case 6, what I have called the Vision of Truth. Just recently, I got some new ideas about it that provide a useful perspective. The main idea is that truth is a story. It's our spiritual life story. In order to be the real truth, it must be the whole truth. And it is. It's the story of our origin, of our existence, and of our destination. Truth is the complete story of our life cycle. And here's the important part. Rather than telling a material story from cradle to grave, our spiritual story goes from everlasting to everlasting. We have an everlasting spiritual principle that is self-existent, apart from the limitations of space and time. This pure principle is the principle of our life, and so it is continually originating us, making us new every morning. We are its offspring, and it is good. Not just very good, but breathtakingly good.
infinitely good. The quality of our lives is forever linked to the extraordinary quality of our goodness of origin, from which we live lives of integrity, harmony, and inviolability that goes on forever. So the story of God's truth is the story of our life in spirit, the ever-unfolding of good from everlasting to everlasting, as the spiritual image and likeness of the I Am God.